You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Jessica Hopkins, toku ingoa, no mai hari mai, ki te waia mō tēnei rā, kia ora, and welcome to The Wire for Rapa Wednesday. I'm your host, Jessica, and I'll be with you for the next hour. E whai akine coming up on the show, I speak to the Scottish Green Party's Equalities and Human Rights Issues spokesperson, Maggie Chapman, as well as Dr. Sarah Bickerton, a research associate at the Public Policy Institute at the University of Auckland and research and policy lead at Toa Toa, about the UK government voting in favour to block a Scottish gender recognition bill. I also speak to Marilyn Garson, co-founder of Alternative Jewish Voices, and Kate Stone, a co-convener of the Coordinating Group for Justice for Palestine, about the extent to which activists for Palestinian rights are being falsely accused of anti-Semitism. And finally, I speak to Safe for Animals CEO Deborah Ashton about their calls to end rodeo. Hea ha ofakado. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku patuhi mai, text me on 5395 or wire my rane. Give us a call in the studio on 309 3879 to let me know about your thoughts on any of our pieces today. Ka awa I wariwari I ahe ana koutou, te whakarongo ki ene kōrero, anō hi pakihiri roki roki mā runga, I te pai tuku tuku o irirangi poho, me haere ki 95BFM, Irakati.com. Catch all of these stories and more by podcast, as always, on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
This is a sad, sad day. BFM, the font of liberalism and tolerance at the centre of the University of Auckland.
The Wire.
This morning, the UK government voted in favour of blocking a Scottish gender recognition bill from going to royal assent that would make it easier for people to change their legally recognised gender. The bill passed by the Scottish Parliament by 86 votes to 39 in December. It's designed to simplify and speed up the process of obtaining a gender recognition certificate, which is needed if you want your affirmed gender to be legally recognised in the UK. The bill lowers the age that people can apply for a gender recognition certificate from 18 to 16, removes the need for a medical diagnosis of gender dysphoria, and reduces the required life test where applicants must have lived in their desired gender for at least 2 years before applying for a certificate to 3 months or 6 months if they're aged 16 or 17. The passing of this bill made Scotland the first nation in the UK to back a self-identification process for legally changing gender. But the UK government has used a Section 35 order, which is a provision which can block Scottish laws, and this is the first time they have ever used this order, to thwart Scotland's efforts to expand trans rights. UK ministers claim the bill would conflict with existing equality laws which apply across Great Britain. Scotland's First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, has said that the Scottish Government will defend the bill, warning that it would be the first of many laws protecting trans and LGBTQIA and minority rights to be affected. I spoke to Scottish Green Party's Equalities and Human Rights Issues spokesperson, Maggie Chapman, who is the vice convener of the Equalities, Human Rights and Civil Justice Committee that took the gender recognition reform legislation through to Scottish Parliament last year. I started our interview by asking about her reaction to the UK government's decision.
Quite frankly, I'm very, very angry. I'm outraged that the UK government has used the powers of the Scotland Act, the Section 35 powers, in this way. I think we always knew that there were elements within the UK government and in the Conservative Party, both in the UK as a whole and in Scotland, that really didn't want to see this legislation pass for a whole range of reasons, I think. But to use these powers, I think, is deeply, deeply problematic. And I think there's something very telling for me that they've chosen to use these powers for the first time on an equalities issue, on an issue about rights, on an issue that what was that? That's about making life easier for an already marginalized and vulnerable group of people. And I think, you know, there are several other instances where the Scottish Parliament has passed legislation or the Scottish Government has stated a position that is contrary to what happens elsewhere within the United Kingdom, and has even perhaps materially affects what happens elsewhere within the United Kingdom. And the UK government have said nothing about it. So to give you an example, the Scottish government, and this is something that the Greens agree with, the Scottish government have a very, very clear anti-nuclear energy position. So we will not have new nuclear energy facilities being built in Scotland. And the UK government, despite being very pro-nuclear, has said that they will not impose nuclear reactors on Scotland. Now, energy is an issue that is reserved. It comes within the powers of the UK government, not the devolved Scottish government. And yet they didn't say anything. The issue that we're talking about today, the gender recognition reform legislation, that is an issue that is within devolved competencies of the Scottish Parliament. So I think it's deeply, deeply concerning, not only that the UK government has taken the step at all, but that they've chosen to do it on an issue of equalities and human rights. I think that speaks volumes about the direction of travel for the UK government and the kind of society they want to see.
This decision using a Section 35 order on an equality issue, what precedent do you think this sets for transgender rights in the UK?
Well, I think it's very concerning. It sets, I think, a very dangerous precedent for the UK government to ride roughshod over devolved powers like this in this way on a rights issue, I think is really, really concerning. We've already seen some of the moves that the UK government are making around the rolling back of other rights. They want to remove the human rights cover that we have by virtue of having been a member of the European Union and the European Convention of Human Rights. They want to remove all of those and introduce what they call a Bill of Rights. But it's quite clear that in that UK government proposal, it's actually a rights removal bill. It's not enhancing or protecting the rights that we currently enjoy. So I think, you know, on one level, we know that the UK government is not committed to international human rights good practice. It's not committed to striving for better human rights. We see that with their treatment of the gender recognition legislation in Scotland and of trans rights in general across these islands. But I think it also says something quite or potentially quite damaging for other minority rights and other equalities issues, if it's so easy in some ways for them to say that this small step that would make the lives of a very small number of people a little bit better, but significantly better, if even that small step they won't let Scotland be out of step with the rest of the UK on. What other policies, what other pieces of legislation will they be prepared to use a Section 35 order on? You know, we don't know the answer to that question yet, but I think it sends a very worrying signal for progressive and rights-based policies that we want to pass in Scotland, but I think rightly now fear being challenged by the UK government.
The UK government has claimed that Scotland's gender recognition bill would conflict with equality laws which apply across Great Britain. What do you make of these claims?
So the different bits of legislation that we're talking about here, the UK government in 2010 passed the Equality Act, and that covers the whole of the United Kingdom, and it remains part of the legislation that all of the devolved nations adhere to. There are claims that the gender recognition reform legislation will have an impact will impact on that Equality Act and will interfere with its action. Now, I think there are a couple of points on this. Firstly, the gender recognition reform legislation is about making a process that already exists easier. So it's about making the process for legal gender recognition in Scotland easier through a process of self-declaration. So trans people, rather than having to provide medical evidence, rather than having to provide confirmation of a diagnosis of gender dysphoria, rather than having to provide evidence of having lived in their acquired gender for significant periods of time, it's currently 2 years, that process is what the legislation we passed in the Scottish Parliament last December, that's the process that this makes easier. It's about taking out that medical diagnosis requirement, taking out the requirement for a medical panel to make a determination, and reducing the time for which somebody has to live in their acquired gender. So gender recognition certificates, however, have been in existence since 2004. So people have been able to get legal gender recognition since 2004. And that was, as I said, 6 years before the Equality Act came into being. So if there was conflict with the legislation that we passed in Scotland last December and the Equality Act, which is UK legislation, that conflict would have existed since 2010 because gender recognition legislation existed since 2004. So I know that that's potentially quite a complex argument, but trans people across the UK have been able to get gender recognition certificates since 2004. The Equality Act comes in 2010, and the two work together without any issue. There was seen as no conflict, no issue in 2010. So why there is any conflict now, where it's simply about the process of obtaining a gender recognition certificate, I fail to see how there's any substantive change there. The other thing that I think people are unhappy about, those who are against this legislation are unhappy about, in some ways, is made even less clear, is on the we put into the gender recognition reform legislation that nothing in that bill would affect the Equality Act. We know we can't. We're the Scottish Parliament. We're a devolved parliament. We cannot affect UK-wide legislation. So for me, there's not only an inconsistency in the argument, an inconsistency of logic, there's also a very, very clear inconsistency of practice, because gender recognition certificates have been a thing since long before the Equality Act even came into existence.
So what will your next steps be, particularly as the Green Party or as a parliament in general, for appealing this decision?
There are a couple of avenues that are currently being explored. The Scottish Greens have said very clearly that we will resist the Section 35 order. I think we are, because we have an agreement with the Scottish Government, the Butas Agreement, that we actually modelled on some of the work of New Zealand Greens, and their agreement with your government. Within the Butas Agreement, we have a very, very clear commitment to the gender recognition reform legislation. And so it's likely that if the Scottish Government if the Scottish Government chose to challenge the UK government's Section 35 order in court, that would be fully supported by the Scottish Greens. I think we would like to see that happen. But I think there's also a question in all of this for the Scottish Parliament as a whole. In December, when we voted on the gender recognition legislation, it was backed by over two-thirds of our MSPs. It was backed by members of each of the five parties we have in the Scottish Parliament. So it was overwhelmingly supported by and had cross-party support. And I think given that the UK government is seeking to challenge that, there's a question for the Parliament as a whole. You know, what does that say about the UK government's respecting of devolution, respecting of the Scottish Parliament to make its own laws in devolved areas? What does that say about the UK government's process of acknowledging Scottish democracy in action? And I think that there are questions being asked within the Scottish Parliament itself as well around what are the kinds of challenges that we would want to take as a corporate body. We're still in the very early stages of those discussions, but I am pretty much certain that we will end up, this will end up in court one way or another. Really, we see the UK government's approach here. It's an attack on devolution. So they are undermining the powers that the Scottish Parliament has by right of the Scotland Act or of the devolved settlement. They are undermining the democratic processes of the Scottish Parliament. And I think that's a pretty serious constitutional position for the UK government to be in. But I think for me, actually, the really, really important thing to remember in all of this is what we are talking about: trans people's lives here, and their voice, trans people's voices, trans people's lives are not heard or not often recognized in the midst of all of this. The debate that we've had in Parliament, the long time coming of that legislation, it's been in discussion for over 6 years. During that time, it's been trans people that have been on the brunt of a misinformation campaign, I think quite a cynical stoking of a culture war around trans issues, but wider equalities issues too. And at the heart of this are trans people who just want to live as who they are and be recognized in law as who they are. It's something I take for granted. It's something that most people just take for granted. And I'm very keen to ensure that we don't lose sight of their lives, those voices in all of this, because what the legislation we passed in Scotland last December sought to do was make life easier for those marginalized and already vulnerable trans people who have borne the brunt of disinformation and a cynical culture war. So that's I think where we need to retain our focus. I think what the UK government is doing is deeply damaging for trans people in Scotland, but I think it sends a very negative message around the UK's approach to trans people globally and to equalities issues globally.
I also spoke to Dr. Sarah Bickerton, a research associate at the Public Policy Institute at the University of Auckland and research and policy lead at Tautua Aotearoa Commons, about harmful rhetoric surrounding trans and other minority rights in the UK and the potential implications of blocking this legislation on Scottish democracy.
As of this morning, New Zealand time, the Westminster has voted in favour of the government, through Secretary of State Alistair Jack, voted in favour of enacting Section 35 to block Scotland's gender reform bill from going to royal assent. But in other words, the last step, the last symbolic step before it becomes law. Now, the basis of what Westminster has done this is that they've argued that there is the Equality Bill, that is the Equality Act that's in place for all of the UK, and it sets up a bunch of issues around gender equality, et cetera, et cetera. And they're in place across the entire UK, including Scotland. And what Westminster are arguing is that the Gender Recognition Reform Bill contradicts the Equality Act and would create inconsistencies they're concerned about the ramifications of that. Now, when the Scottish Parliament passed an overwhelmingly, by a super majority, 86 to 39, the Gender Recognition Reform Bill, there's actually a section section in it that says that this bill does not conflict with the Equality Act. But the UK Parliament has decided that the concerns of Secretary of State Alistair Jack are sufficient to warrant this unprecedented constitutional move of enacting Section 35. And there's going to be some really interesting ramifications from that as a result.
And as well as claiming that it conflicts with existing equality laws in the UK, UK ministers have also, what it appears to be, have been influenced by harmful rhetoric about trans people. For example, that allowing trans people to more easily change their legally recognised gender, that this would threaten women's safety. What do you think about these kind of claims and how they influence laws like this?
Well, as a social scientist, I've got two ways in which I can look at that kind of concern. One of them is to look at the evidence, and the other one is to look at it from a theoretical perspective. The evidence from other countries that have so-called self-ID laws, where they've reduced the restrictions on trans people being able to more easily change their ID documentation. Like Ireland, Denmark, Argentina is particularly the one that's been around for a long time, and recently, of course, New Zealand. The evidence shows that those concerns aren't justified. We're not seeing waves of women's rights being eroded. Because for the most part, cis women and trans women pretty much occupy similar social categories. So they operate similarly, and so there is no eroding of the category of women or women's spaces because of this. So that's the evidence doesn't actually show that. And then from a theoretical perspective, doing a gender analysis, it doesn't really stack up. We interact with each other in everyday life on the basis of gender. The actual situation, whether or not someone is cis or trans, doesn't really play a part in terms of how we occupy ourselves as women or men or non-binary persons. That's the primary category. And then trans women have things that are particular to themselves, and cis women have things that are particular to themselves. But they both occupy a space as women. And as we've discovered, that including other women in the category of women, understanding the needs of white women versus non-white women, indigenous women versus immigrant women, disabled women versus non-disabled women, you expand and understand you've got a multiplicity of women occupying these this gender category, and that's how we interact with each other. We don't interact with each other based upon going up and checking what genitals, what chromosomes, what hormone arrangements, etc., what skeletal structures we have with each other. Something that we do on the basis of gender. We don't do it on the basis of sex. Now, have they've raised some concerns around issues regarding sports, issues regarding prisons, et cetera, or women's spaces. The data shows that women in sport, trans, if there were a sporting advantage that we were seeing for trans women, we would see them dominating women's sport, and we just don't see that. So these concerns, while for some people may be validly held, when you look at the data, it just doesn't support it. Now, why this is occurring particularly in the UK is that anyone that's been paying a particular attention to this notices that over the UK, over the last couple of decades or so, the UK has got, and particularly in the last decade, UK has gotten institutionally more transphobic in a way that's unprecedented across the rest of the world. We are seeing in the last 5 years or so an increase in the US and of transphobia as a product of trans visibility, growing acceptance and inclusion of trans people, but also losses against conservative pushes against gay rights. And so there's been a shift from opposing gay rights to using transphobic narratives to not just attack trans people, but also reuse and reinvoke traditional anti-gay homophobic narratives. And you'll discuss that. You'll notice that if you look at any of the arguments used against trans people, it's just recycled homophobia applied to trans people. And it shouldn't be a shocker. If you're doing that kind of political analysis, you can see the same kind of arguments being made. But that's the US, and we're seeing those rises of violence and hatred, et cetera, in the US. But the UK has a particular context of it being highly institutionalized in politics, in law, et cetera, in institutions, in a way that's quite different from the rest of the world. And it's not a shocker that we would see the UK Parliament, particularly through a Conservative government, block this legislation, that this legislation would be the thing that would trigger Section 35 use, because of that historical institutionalized transphobia.
And the passing of this bill would make Scotland the first nation in the UK to back the self-identification process for legally changing gender. Could you go over for our listeners a bit about what a self-identification process would mean for trans people?
Yeah, so self-ID is a rather broad category. It's not really a legal term, but more it's like a descriptor for a series of passages that allow trans people to have an easier process to garner identification documents in for their new or like their wished for gender identification. And in New Zealand, we saw this last year in passage of the amendments to changing our birth certificates in New Zealand. And previously, self-ID had been established for a long time in regards to passports. And the legislation that went through in New Zealand meant that trans people didn't have to go through a court process, a literal court process, to get their birth certificate changed. Involved generally, involved getting a lawyer involved. It had to massive amounts of documentation. It took a while. If anybody that's gone through the court process knows that they're not the fastest. So this was considerably cost, time, and impact on life for trans people to be able to do this kind of really basic thing, to have their identification documents aligning and able to be used for their everyday life. And so the legislation that falls under the self-ID descriptor in New Zealand involves simply aligning birth certificate processes with passport, et cetera, where trans people aren't required to now go before a court judge to they can do it through self-affirmation, and the medical requirements on them to be gatekept by medical professionals in order to live as their preferred gender were made easier for them to do so. They still have to go through a number of steps, of course, to do the self-identification. It's not simply a matter of rocking it up and saying, hey, I am so-and-so. There's still some work to do. But it's faster, it's easier, it's cheaper, which means that particularly for trans people, those that are in vulnerable communities alongside their trans identity, there is less of a barrier for them to be able to access the identification documents as their authentic self. And that's pretty much how self-ID has been working around the other countries that have been adopting this, is removing the medicalization requirements, removing the legal hurdles, and just making it consistent with existing legislation as it was in New Zealand, and relying on them as citizens to affirm that this is something that they wish to do, giving power to these kind of minorities to be able to identify themselves rather than gatekeeping their ability to fully participate in society.
Is there anything else that you think is important for people to consider in regards to this topic?
I think the major thing is it's for the majority of us, this isn't going to impact us. This kind of legislation does not impact us. The data doesn't show that it's going to impact us. It's going to allow one of the most vulnerable communities in our society to be able to fully participate. And to a certain extent, it shouldn't affect us. It's administrative legislation that allows us to go, okay, this community gets included. And I think that's the really important thing to focus on.
The Conservative Party has declining support. Are you hopeful that conditions may improve for trans people in the UK?
Oh, to be honest, at the moment, I would say probably not in the short term. In the longer term, yes, I think this kind of stuff will eventually happen. These kind of restrictions, this kind of institutionalized transphobia will decrease and things will be better for trans people in the UK. In the immediate term, regarding the Scottish Gender Recognition Reform Bill, where the Nicola Sturgeon, the Scottish First Minister, has said that she will go towards a legal challenge to this through judicial review, that the basis for the Section 35 enactment will be challenged. But this is unprecedented. We don't know if that would be successful. The interesting thing is then what is going to happen, the ramifications of the enactment of Section 35, what ramifications for Scottish independence. So in that, when we ask what's going to be the situation for trans people in the UK, we're almost going to be asking now what's the ramifications in general for the UK as we know it today, because we may be looking at far more higher degrees of independence pushes occurring within the UK, particularly via Scotland initially. And so Scotland may be a differing context from the UK going forward as a result of this.
That was the Scottish Green Party's Equalities and Human Rights Issues spokesperson, Maggie Chapman, followed by Dr. Sarah Bickerton from the University of Auckland on the UK government blocking a Scottish gender recognition bill. We'll be back right after this short break. Keep it on the B.
Marlon Williams' My Boy Tour is coming to the Civic this Thursday and Friday. With a different special guest each night of the tour, Thursday sees our boy Marlon joined by Nadia Reid and Friday by Vera Allen. Marlon Williams and the Yarra Benders, performing songs from My Boy live at the Civic. This Friday is sold out. Tickets for this Thursday are going fast. Get yours now from Ticketmaster.
What's a seven-letter word for Street Fighter?
No idea. I know that tonight at Ponsonby Social Club there's
Botico Beats with Enrique Morales and guests with support by Bobby Brazuca.
And tomorrow,
a live tribute to Tame Impala followed by DJs Carlotta, Malika and Katya.
Same old Ponsonby Social Club, 152 Ponsonby Road.
The Morningside Live Block Party is coming up and we've got a bunch of tickets to give away, you lucky dingoes. So you can get amongst it with Fat Freddy's Drop, Ruby Doo, Lucky Lance and Christabel Trento, Haz and Milo and more. So get your B-card handy and stay tuned to 95 BFM Drive all this week for your chance to win. 95 BFM and Urban Arts Brewing present Morningside Live Block Party, Sunday, February 5th on McDonald Street. Tickets from MoshTix.
At this radio station, we do our utmost to abide by the Broadcasting Standards Authority and their rules and guidelines. If you seriously think we've crossed the line on air, give us a call on 309 4831 within 20 working days of the broadcast date and tell us about it. We'll be able to help you out and tell you the procedure if you wish to make a formal complaint to the Broadcasting Standards Authority. Fuck knuckles, cock and piss. Balls. Thank you.
But in terms of comparing it to the current prison system, though, would you say that it could be an improvement?
I mean, no, how do you improve a piece of shit?
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. Justice of Palestine and Alternative Jewish Voices have carried out a survey to determine the extent to which people who speak up for Palestinian rights are being falsely accused of anti-Semitism to silence their voices. This was in response to surveys on anti-Semitism published in Aotearoa in 2022 that labelled those who held human rights views similar to groups such as Amnesty International as being anti-Semitic. I spoke to both organisations about the results of their survey, which showed the extent of the impact of these accusations in Aotearoa. First, I speak to Marilyn Garson, a co-founder of Alternative Jewish Voices. Can you tell us a bit about your organization, Alternative Jewish Voices, and its purpose?
Yeah, we are just about 3 years old, and we speak about three issues. We speak about the narrowness of the leadership of the Jewish community. We speak in support of Palestinians who are seeking their own freedom, and we speak about this issue of anti-Semitism. Those are our three.
Alongside the organization Justice for Palestine, you've carried out a survey which is said is to counter the confusion of some of the surveys published in 2022 in Aotearoa, which labeled those advocating for Palestine as being anti-Semitic. Can you tell us a little bit about what you found was problematic about these surveys and their definition of anti-Semitism?
I can say technically the issue is that they use a definition called the IHRA working definition that considers protest of Israel's actions to be a hatred of Jews. That's a false connection. More meaningfully to many people, I'm looking right now at the survey that was done by the New Zealand Jewish Council. One of the statements that respondents were asked to agree or disagree with, the statement says, Israel is the only real democracy in the Middle East. Well, if you believe that Palestinians have a right to vote for the government that governs their lives, you have to disagree with that statement. And if you disagree with that statement, your answer goes straight into a column called anti-Semitic. So by protesting the disenfranchisement of Palestinians, you become labeled as a Jew hater. That's the essence of the problem. Speech that upholds our human rights, international law, is not speech about or against Jews or Jewishness. We wanted to document the experience and the impact of being called anti-Semitic.
What are some of the findings of your survey on how this has influenced people in Aotearoa in their discussions about Israel and Palestine?
Well, first I would say we found the extent of the distortion of our respondents. 93% had been called anti-Semitic regarding comments on the actions of the Israeli state. Only two of our respondents had ever been called anti-Semitic in the course of conversations about Jews. So we found that it was deeply distorted, and we found a range of impacts. Some people just paused and reflected on how they speak and tried to respond constructively to the accusations. Some experienced really serious issues in their relationships, issues with their reputation within their families, sometimes their health and well-being. And the way that these accusations are being made is unanswerable. So people are simply having to live with this label, and that's hard.
almost a quarter of your respondents were Jewish. What was some of their perspectives on this issue?
The Jewish respondents almost entirely were the group who spoke about relationship impacts, difficulties in family, with friends, diminishing their participation or having to leave Jewish institutions, the experience of standing up within one's own community to seek justice for others is particularly or differently punishing.
Based on your survey, to what extent do you think people in New Zealand understand the nature of anti-Semitism and what it is?
That's a good question, because a part of the problem with this issue is the confusion that it generates. The survey that I referred to earlier, the Jewish Council survey, concluded that two-thirds of New Zealanders hold some anti-Semitic attitudes. That's pretty confusing until you understand that the majority of those were simply attitudes toward Israel's actions within its illegal occupation. Our respondents made a really clear distinction between anti-Semitic statements and statements about the state of Israel and or the rights of Palestinians. Those are not anti-Semitic statements. One of the reasons why we would like the government to publicly put this definition on a shelf and say we won't be using it is because it erodes our shared understanding of what anti-Semitism is. We need to combat all forms of racism. This is not helping.
How can people approach discussions about Israel and Palestine? Where are some resources, or what are some ways people can approach those discussions with people who may have confusion about the difference between anti-Semitism and Zionism?
Well, I can answer that on a couple of levels. Our own Human Rights Commission and the United Nations Rapporteur on Racism have both written about the importance of combating racism in ways that are rights-based, in ways that uphold and enhance our rights. And the answer lies in there. Speech about the rights of Palestinians is positive, pro-rights, is always allowed. Speech about something in the Jews that creates this problem, you know, that's an alarm bell. You can hear the difference between speech that is about our human equality and speech that singles out and denigrates a group. We need to get back to trusting our ability to hear those things. We need to learn to disregard the accusation that a political position is the same as a religion. I would also want to draw people's attention to the point that we make in the appendix. We are not simply feeling negative about this definition. We are trying to return to a positive, rights-based way forward. We need to combat racism together. This definition is a way to separate anti-Semitism, and there's no future in that. We need to link arms on this.
Then I spoke to Kate Stone, a co-convener of the Coordinating Group for Justice for Palestine, a human rights organization working in Aotearoa to promote justice, peace, and freedom for the Palestinian people. We started our interview discussing why it is important for New Zealand to ensure people can stand up for Palestinian rights.
I think the first thing is to just step back and think about what the underlying issue is. So the underlying issue is an attempt to conflate pro-Palestinian human rights advocacy with anti-Semitism. And let's be really clear, Justice for Palestine and Alternative Jewish Voices absolutely do not support anti-Semitism and stand up for the human rights of all people, including Jewish people. So when we're advocating for Palestinian human rights, that does not at all mean that we don't support the human rights of Jewish people as well. The conflation of Zionism and anti-Semitism is the conflation of the settler colonial project of Zionism, which is trying to remove Palestinian, indigenous Palestinian people from their land. through a violent and illegal occupation. And that's definitely not the same thing as anti-Jewish racism. And as I said, that's something which just Palestine and alternative Jewish voices absolutely stand up against. So what the intention of the survey was to really dig down into how this conflation of Zionism and anti-Semitism operates on a daily basis against people who are trying to advocate for Palestinian human rights. And so Justice for Palestine has a long-running relationship with alternative Jewish voices, organising around Palestinian human rights more generally, and we worked alongside alternative Jewish voices to put the survey together, get it out there, get folks that organise around Palestinian human rights to respond, and then to review and present the findings.
And your survey identified significant well-being and emotional and health effects on people that were advocating for Palestine, in particular those of Arab descent or non- or anti-Zionist members of the Jewish community. So can you go into a bit more detail about some of the impacts those people have experienced?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really important point to note that when doing Palestinian human rights advocacy work, it doesn't affect all people equally. Some people become are more targets for this kind of behaviour. And as you've said, that in this case, it's Palestinians, people of Arab descent, and Jewish advocates for Palestinian human rights that are often most targeted and also for quite obvious reasons most affected by this kind of thing. So I thought it might just be helpful just even to read some of the comments that people have said with the impact of the kind of accusations of anti-Semitism that they received. So things like it makes it exhausting to have to be so clear and careful so not to be misconstrued as anti-Semitic when I am supporting Palestine and her people. I suppose it achieves what they want to make our lives harder and to stop us from speaking out and organising for fear, distress and exhaustion. People have said it makes them feel outraged. Others have said that they no longer go to their synagogue on a regular basis, that it's significantly affected their health and made the general sense of safety and belonging, and affected their general sense of safety and belonging in the Jewish community, alienated them from participating in Jewish community activities, generally feeling alienated from their community and their family, feeling intimidated and ostracized, feeling that invalidates their cause and makes them feel helpless. And I think one of the comments I just read before is really at the crux of it, which is that it makes people who are standing up for the human rights of Palestinians and the human rights of people everywhere, it makes them feel like they can't do that, that they should step away from that work. And that's the real threat of this type of unfounded accusation of anti-Semitism. That's basically the instrumentalization of anti-Semitism. It's making false accusations of anti-Semitism in order to advance the cause of the settler colonial cause of Zionism. And that does a disservice to the human rights of everyone, both Palestinian people, Israelis, Jewish, and all of us.
Do you think the government needs to do more to ensure that the effects on those of Arab descent or our Palestinian community in Aotearoa, as well as those anti-Zionist members of the Jewish community, feel supported?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the key things that we're asking for here is that the New Zealand government and local authorities in New Zealand do not support the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance Working Definition of Anti-Semitism, which sort of encapsulates this issue of conflating resistance to Zionism and settler colonialism in Palestine, conflating resistance to that with anti-Semitism. And there's a strong movement to try and get international bodies, states and local authorities to basically adopt this definition of anti-Semitism, which would then be used when we are trying to address things like hate speech and so on. But the problem with that is that it would have the effect of actually impinging upon the ability of people to advocate for Palestinian human rights. And this is something which has been spoken about at the international level as well. There's a whole lot of scholars came out towards the end of last year urging the United Nations not to adopt the definition for this very reason. So we're urging the government not to align itself with this definition. And then, as people are probably aware, there's a lot of work going on at the moment around hate speech laws and that kind of thing. And it's really important that when those conversations are happening, that we're alive to this particular issue, and that any changes that we make to our laws and policies don't have the effect of dampening down human rights advocacy, including for the rights of Palestinians.
That was Marilyn Garson from Alternative Jewish Voices, followed by Kate Stone from Justice for Palestine on their concerns around false accusations of anti-Semitism. And the deaths of three animals during rodeo events over the summer have prompted animal advocates to renew their calls for the government to urgently ban rodeo. I spoke to SAFE CEO Deborah Ashton about what rodeo events entail and why they are opposing it.
There's around about 35 events throughout the country and throughout the rodeo season. There's a lot of different events in rodeo itself, including there's about seven events. There's bareback or saddle bronc riding. There's barrel racing. There's bull and steer riding. There's also calf riding, rope and tie, which is really known as calf roping, steer wrestling and team roping. So all of these activities are inherently cruel to animals. Animals used in rodeo are subjected to fear and stress. They also run the risk of, you know, quite severe injuries such as torn ligaments, broken bones, bruising and internal damage. And sadly, in the worst cases, these injuries can be so severe that the animals can die or they need to be killed on site.
Safe for Animals has reported that three animals died in rodeo events between December 28th and December 30th last year. Can you tell us a bit about these incidents and if these deaths or traumatic injuries are common at events like these?
Well, look, you know, there were three animals that lost their lives just in 3 days between Christmas and New Year. So we saw a bull that was killed in Opotiki after breaking their leg in the arena. On the 30th of December, a second bull was killed after suffering a spinal injury in Te Anau. And a horse died after having a seizure at a rodeo event. So those three events for animals were very, very severe. You know, the worst cases that we see at rodeo. Even following those events, another horse suffered a significant injury when their leg was degloved after getting it stuck in the rails of a chute. It's not a good look for the Rodeo Cowboys Association or their call to continue using animals in this way. You know, animals are being put at this sort of risk all of the time. And while, you know, we don't see deaths at every single event, I think animals are subjected to unnecessary stress and suffering all for the sake of entertainment.
Is there any way for rodeo to improve conditions and the safety of animals at their events, or do you not see this as a possibility?
We don't think so. We think the risk to the animals is inherent. You know, it's just inherent of the activity and the way that these animals are being used. We've heard the Rodeo Cowboys Association time and time again talk about, you know, making improvements and making changes to the way that they operate. But we think, you know, despite any of those changes that they're trying to make, we don't think it's really going to make a significant difference for those animals.
What would your call to the government be in their response to this issue? Do you think that they have done enough to protect animals in these rodeo events?
I think the government's response has been slow, and that's why SAFE teamed up with the New Zealand Animal Law Association and filed proceedings against the government for their failure to ban rodeo. So we took the government to court last year. The court declined to make a ruling on the legality of rodeo and dismissed the judicial review, saying that the proper place to challenge this would be during consultation with the government's advisors, NAWAC. So that process is underway now, but it has certainly taken a long time. And I think a lot of animals have suffered. They're continuing to suffer while this review of the Code of Welfare for Rodeo is being done. Ideally, we would have seen a halt on all rodeo activity until the review was done. And, you know, we would also see now what people boycotting rodeo and saying, well, you know, hang on a minute, if animals are suffering, why would we want to go and support that kind of activity? So it has been a slow process, but it is underway now, and we're very, very much involved in that process. I think, you know, to go to rodeo and see animals being routinely grabbed, chased and wrestled and roped at a fast pace, when you look at those sort of activities, you would sort of consider that if you did that to a dog, you could be charged with animal abuse. So it's a case of looking at those animals as sentient beings like any other animals and, you know, asking ourselves, is that the way we should be treating them?
That was SAFE CEO Deborah Ashton on their calls to ban rodeo events.
That was The Wire.
Ko era te hotaka katoa, mō tēne wiki, ni te mihi, ki a koutou katoa, I kōrero mai ki o mō tēne rā. That's a wrap on The Wednesday Wire. Thanks to everyone who spoke with us today. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is The Wonderful with Bridge.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.